From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar with Eric Dreitzer from New York and Mark Sloboda from Moscow. Mark, Eric, welcome back.
Hey, Don. Thanks again.
Don, Eric, it's great to be on CPR as always.
And this week, it's Mark at the lead, so that's for you.
Do you want to phrase a question?
Or oh, no, that was it. I just knocked the ball into your court.
Okay. Well, I think certainly the most dramatic news over the past week, of course, is the collapse of the Geneva III peace talks in Turkey, as the Riyadh assembled jihad jamboree pulled out when they discovered that Russia and the Syrian Arab Army are not going to stop their advances and are moving very quickly now as the entire front in the north, west, and north central Syria begins to collapse due to, you know, not only the bombing, you know, but the cutting of supply lines, the damaging of convoys, the destruction of the economy, and of course huge losses of morale at this point.
They're in a real war now, those guys. Those terrorists are like in a big boys game now.
They're not you know, just taking over small Christian villages with you know, people who can't defend themselves, or the Syrian Arab Army is not the beleaguered force that it once was. It has, as I've mentioned before on this show, largely been reconstituted by Russian military advisors and refashioned along Russian lines using an artillery heavy joint mobile operations system, which is proving very effective.
And with world-class air cover, too. You know,
plus the air cover. Yeah. But whenever they're not able to have the air cover directly on hand, they have the artillery formations, and Russia has provided multiple rocket launch systems, which the Russian military makes great use of, has since World War II days. You'll see, for our, some of our listeners may know what a Katusha is, as they were used in World War II, and they have not dropped out of Russian military doctrine, their use, you know, across large swaths of territory since then. But following that, I think perhaps more interestingly and more forebodingly, both Turkey and Saudi Arabia. Well, Saudi Arabia has announced that they are going to send, or they are willing to send, ground troops into Syria, quote unquote, to fight Daesh, the Islamic State. And I don't think there's anyone out there, even among the Western media I've seen, that actually is going to, you know, put their credibility on the line by saying they believe that Saudi Arabia is going to fight the Islamic State.
Who's going to be paying the Islamic State salary while it's fighting Saudi Arabia?
Yeah,
I mean, did the Saudis first send them checks and then bomb them? How's it work?
I think it's a form of self-flagellation. I believe it's some Saudi ritual. But also, the Russian military has announced that they see signs that Turkey is preparing, likewise, a military incursion into northern Syria. There's been a lot of talk about this for a long time. There was a pre-scheduled flight, Russian flight over Turkey, which is a NATO member, per the Open Skies Treaty, that was supposed to take place over Turkey this last week. Turkey denied Russia the right to fly over, and Russia responded right away, okay, if you think you're going to be hiding what you're doing there by not allowing this treaty, you think that's our only means of gathering information?
Look at these pictures.
They specifically said, this is just unprofessional, right? You're not hiding anything and you're just being unprofessional. Yeah. And it should be noted that Russia allowed 32 flights over its territory last year, four of them conducted by Turkey. Mm. And this was at a time that Russia allowed them, when supposedly, at least if you believe some Western and sources that were just repeating what the Kiev regime was saying, that tens of thousands of Russian troops were supposedly pouring into Ukraine,
that no one
ever saw or got a picture of, and certainly were never identified by the Open Skies Treaty flights.
Right.
So people were talking about, will Turkey and Saudi Arabia coordinate, as is obviously intended, by putting ground troops on the ground in Syria? And it's rather interesting. The British Foreign Secretary Hammond this week made a rather bizarre statement, angry statement about Russian and the Syrian Arab Army advances, and said that Russia was trying to carve up Syria and create a Alawite mini state. This is rather bizarre because they're obviously moving far past this, and this is simply not giving them enough credit. They want to liberate the entirety of the country, and they think they can do it at this point. And what is actually happening is that Turkey and Saudi Arabia, of course, backed by the United States and the United Kingdom fully, may try to carve out a piece of eastern and northern Syria as some type of Salafistan, a fundamentalist Sunni state, basically just another Islamic state with a different formation.
Let me just say to Eric this part, because what you brought up before we get into that part, you know, looking at what might develop, if you have, it's one thing if the Saudis send troops into Syria, of course it's illegal. And of course the U.S. and the Saudis have treaties and contracts and all of that, but it's not the same as Turkey. As they go into Syria to engage, and the opportunity for a clash between Russian troops and, say, either Turkish or Saudi troops, the U.S. isn't compelled by treaty if they take out the Saudis illegally in Syria, but they might invoke NATO if the Turks do.
I just want to quickly add that Saudi Arabia has also said that Qatar, Bahrain, Morocco, Malaysia, Sudan, and a whole group of other countries evidently are willing to participate to this mission. I don't know if Malaysia's actually been informed or not. They weren't the last time they were included on a Saudi list.
Okay. A lot of things I think that need to be said. Look, this is a very dangerous situation, and it's particularly dangerous for Erdogan. Whether he understands the danger or not is, at this point, somewhat up in the air, because he has been acting in a way that, to me, is now beginning, at least from my perspective, calling into question whether he is actually seeing objective reality anymore or not.
Is he sane, or is he
insane, or who's in his ear telling him that, you know? I mean, this is a very real question, because he is really dancing on the edge of a knife here. And from my perspective, and, you know, I have nothing positive to say, as everyone knows my work, I have nothing positive to say about NATO or about the United States ever. However, I will say that all indications up to this point are the United States wants no part of Erdogan getting involved in a direct war with Russia.
The United States immediately jumped out and said they support the Saudi idea of sending troops.
That's something different, and I'll get to that in a second, because that goes into a different strategy. But with regard to Turkey, look, there is a very real question now about the stability of the Erdogan government, and that whether or not they're going to be able to even survive this, because ultimately what we're now seeing is more or less what will amount to a two-front war for Turkey if they invade into Syria, because they're already fighting a war against the Kurds in their own country. I mean, just today we have new reports of not just clashes, but outright battles happening in Diyarbakir, this major Kurdish city, the unofficial capital of Kurdish Turkey. This, you know, supposedly they've killed, I mean, the Turkish military supposedly have killed something like 750 PKK militants. But there's also something like 25 to 30,000 civilians who are now fleeing. I mean, they are now waging war against their own population. If on top of that, Turkey moves forward with an outright invasion into Syria, now this calls something else into question, because with Russian military involved there, and they're not, look, let's be serious here. Russian military is not simply flying sorties. They're on the ground. They're advising the Syrian military. They've got people there. I'm sure there's special forces involved there doing all kinds of things, you know, all of the covert actions, all of this. So what this means then is military forces on the ground would be a direct clash between Turkey and Russia. Now, from my perspective, I see some of the statements from the United States, even going back to the Turkey shooting down the Su-24, the Russian jet. Basically, the United States were like, go deal with the Russians on your own, you know, and I think the reality is that has pushed Erdogan to think that he has to escalate this in order to drag NATO directly into this. Now, there's two ways of looking at that. Number one would be that a Turkish-Russian direct military engagement then becomes a Russian-NATO direct military engagement under what Don was describing, you know, the collective security clause, all of that, collective defense clause, all of that. There is a second option here that I think is also something to keep in mind. The CIA has a major, major problem with Erdogan, and that is that his main rival is the Gulen network. And Gulen, Fethullah Gulen, who sits here in the United States, who runs one of the largest international networks of schools, Islamic schools and so forth, Gulen, who is in bed with the CIA, who despises Erdogan, Gulen, who controls a lot of those Turkish opposition media outlets that Erdogan has been going after, Gulen undoubtedly wants Erdogan destroyed. Could this then be the moment in which the United States now throws its weight against Erdogan to remove him from power and put a Gulenist in power or some other party so that they can then extricate themselves from the brink of war with Russia? Because they know perfectly the United States at this point and NATO, sure, they could have a war with Russia, but they know what road that's going down. And I think that they're not quite ready to go down that road, nor do the Russians want to go down that road, as they've said 1,000 times over and over again. Remember, Russia reached out to the United States repeatedly about things like, you know, joint missions to retrieve downed jets and things like that. They're both sides, I think, are somewhat wary of this. Now, I'm not suggesting there aren't people in Washington who would like to drive towards that, but This is a very real question. Erdogan's legitimacy and stability is, I think, in question here. Secondarily, I think we also need to ask ourselves what exactly Turkey would actually be able to achieve militarily on the ground. They have pretty much lost the connection that they have to Aleppo. What's happened in the last week, especially with the major gains in the area of Aleppo, the Aleppo governorate, this basically is probably the single most important strategic and tactical shift of balance of power in that part of Syria since 2012, since the rebels took over Aleppo, rebels, terrorists, whatever, took over Aleppo. Now we're seeing a change in the very character of the conflict in that part of the country. To me, this signals a very dangerous moment for Turkey, because if the Russians and the Syrian Arab Army and Hezbollah and all of the, you know, their allied forces, if they truly regain control over Aleppo and are able to encircle it and lay siege to it and all of the rest of that, that now means that Turkey really only has one particular corridor that they can look at, and that's the corridor towards Idlib. But that is now under assault by Russian bombing as well. So basically, Erdogan is in a corner, and the question is, will he act like a, you know, like a cornered animal, right, and lash out and strike out in a suicidal way, or will he realize the fundamental reality that he's not going to be able to go towards regime change in Syria, and that now he has to shift to a defensive posture against the Kurds and against all of these other elements? I think the character of how Erdogan has prosecuted this war and has carried, you know, carried out Turkish policy, troubling, that is now going to shift significantly.
You know, Mark, one thing that I'm looking like larger than the immediate theater is that in the event Erdogan goes off the ranch and the United States is reluctant, and I'm sure they're aware of this, and it's part of the calculus, reluctant to go to full-scale war against Russia, basically, under the NATO treaty. Are there going to be calls, mischief-making, coming from the Baltics, from Ukraine, from Poland, like, hey, if you don't defend Turkey, what are you going to do with us?
Yeah, of course. And we shouldn't certainly underestimate the linkages that are already occurring between Erdogan's regime in Turkey and the West-backed regime in Kiev. They have already started and been quite public about it, building military relations. And there's some evidence that actually during the initial takeover in Ukraine right after the Maidan putsch, when things were starting to unfoil in Crimea, that Erdogan was actually putting some Crimean Tatars who had been fighting in Syria on a plane, and that they were going to fly into Simferopol to take it over before the Russian-backed Crimean militias seized it themselves. They reacted very quickly, and this flight, there's recordings of it. It was an unscheduled flight, turned around midair and flew back to Turkey. And there's a lot of questions in the Russian internet that looks at such military matters about what exactly was going on there. And there's reports in from Mariupol in Donbass. And I've confirmed this myself from people on the ground, that there are hundreds of Turkish and Arabic speaking mercenaries now in Mariupol, in Ukraine, occupied portions of the Donbass.
I just want to add that shouldn't surprise anybody. I think that everybody in the West, military people, forget the emotional side of this, and you know, I let me not say that. We don't want to forget the emotional side. We know how devastating the whole war has been, but I just mean from a purely strategic perspective, the military, the Kiev military, has shown itself to be utterly feckless, and I think that the West and the United States and their puppets in Kiev understand that. So battle-hardened jihadis and Turkish-backed militants and all of the rest of them on the ground there is almost, you know, beyond dispute. I think anybody understands that they need them on the ground because they can't trust their own military.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, actually, anti-Putin reporters writing in Foreign Policy, Anna Nemtsova, earlier wrote a piece about Chechen veterans from ISIS,
exactly,
who were there. And I mean, she's not exactly a disputable source, as she hates Putin and Russia and everything about it. Eric is trying to draw a line between Erdogan's rhetoric at this point and the White House, and I'm not so sure I'm buying that. Whatever the CIA may feel about it, we have every indication that Obama and Erdogan have very good relations. In fact, Obama listed Erdogan as one of the four leaders in the world that he has established the best relationships with just in the last half a year. So I'm not seeing the U.S. throwing him under the bus. at least not in terms of some type of regime change or something like that.
I just want to add, fair enough, Mark, although I am of the opinion that Obama's opinion is probably not even close to the most important one, nor do I think that Obama is the one who would ultimately make a decision as to whether or not to dump the Erdogan regime.
Yeah, I'm not even so sure I agree with you there. I'm fully of the opinion that the military, the CIA, the White House are not in the same page these days. But at the end of the day, I do believe that Obama still has executive authority, however unwilling he is to use it, and whatever the CIA and the military may try to do behind his back, they can't disobey direct orders from him. I wouldn't go that far down the conspiracy line, but we'll certainly see, and I could be proven wrong on that. You mentioned this corridor to Idlib, and this is very important because at this point right now, Idlib, which is entirely controlled by al-Nusra, that is al-Qaeda at this point, right, as are the majority of the forces in Aleppo, al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, and others that, like, such as the Free Syrian Army, who are cooperating with them, allied with them. You'll never hear that in the Western media. They will never admit, as they're crying for the anti-Assad rebels in Aleppo, they'll never tell you that we're crying for al-Qaeda. You won't hear that out of them at all. They will never admit that. But Idlib is entirely controlled by al-Nusra, al-Qaeda. And they have now been cut off from their fuel supply, which was ISIS. They were buying fuel from ISIS. They've engaged with them militarily over some territorial spats. Before that, they were allied with them. Now they sometimes fight with them, sometimes trade with them, but they certainly got their oil from them for operating. And now that's now been cut. And not only is the Syrian Arab Army advancing, but the Kurds are advancing from the west at the same time and are basically expanding the corridor across the north of Aleppo that the Syrian Arab Army has created. So we can see the Kurds there and the Syrian Arab Army operating in perfect concert, to those who aren't paying attention. If there's any type of incursion by Turkey and/or Saudi Arabia and the United States, first of all, we have to, of course, say that this is completely illegal. This is an aggressive act in violation of sovereign Syria, against all international law, against the United Nations Charter. Damascus has come out just in the last few hours and said directly that any ground operations that occur without their permission are an aggressive act and will be treated as such. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the potency of this is somewhat reduced by the fact that neither Syria nor Russia have been actively defending incursions into their airspace and territory that have already occurred and occurred daily, not only by Turkey, which has been bombing the Kurds, just this last week, shelling into Syria itself, as Russian military recorded on video, which NATO just brushed off and didn't even address. The United States and the UK are flying over Turkish Syrian airspace every day without the permission or coordination with the Syrian government. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Russia and Syria haven't tried to enforce Syria's sovereignty before this, in the hopes of a political settlement and in the hopes of giving the West an off-ramp from this whole situation by making it about the fight against ISIS rather than the fight to regime change Syria, I think that was a mistake. And I think at this point, any attempt to try to claim some type of sovereignty for Syria, which the West has obviously ignored, will just continue to be ignored. Certainly the press could care less. So We're left with a crisis of sovereignty for Syria that has already been eroded so far that the world outside of Russia, Iran and those will simply sit by, and of course nothing can be done when everything is done with the backing of the United States and the Security Council.
I want to add very quickly, Don, I'm sorry if I cut you off. Very quickly. One other point, just to sort of contribute to the point that Mark was making and that I was alluding to, in Idlib, Al-Nusra Front and some of their other allied Salafi groups that they're working with and or competing with, they're not simply getting support from the Islamic State in the form of these, oil purchases and all of the rest of that. We have documented evidence, including people that I spoke with who were on the ground in Idlib at the time in the summer of 2014, direct air support from Turkey in Idlib for al-Nusra Front. Yeah. That's confirmed by multiple sources. Now, the reason I bring that up is because I just want to illustrate for people an example of how significant Russia's engagement has been to changing this calculus. Once Russia got involved, and specifically once Russia really took control over the establishment of Syrian airspace and the sort of the let's call it the sovereignty of Syrian airspace, that has changed significantly what Turkey is able to do. They're really not able anymore to send in attack helicopters like they were before to basically provide air support for al-Nusra advances. They're not able to do that. And so they were reduced to these very stretched out supply lines as really the only means of backing the jihadi elements. And now they're really not able to do that. I wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago, about some of these battlefield, tactical changes. And one of the significant things that the Syrian Arab Army has been able to do with the assistance of Russian airstrikes has been to compartmentalize and to cut off these cities from each other. Looking at the map, you look at this north-south corridor, Idlib in the north, Latakia west of that, but further south you go to Hama and Damascus and Homs and Dera. That entire north-south corridor is now fractured. It's no longer an easy access route from one city to the next. And because of that, and because of Russia's call it air security that they're providing, now we begin to see that actually these rebel groups and terrorist groups that are in control of the various cities, they're not able to work together. They now have to work independent of each other. And because they work independently, they're losing badly. One other point I want to make.
Let me just ask you something on that point, which is, now that we're seeing basically these strikes and the actions of the Syrian Arab Army and the Kurds breaking up, Al-Qaeda-stan, and this condition prevails on the ground now where you have these enclaves that are surrounded, essentially. Is there a possibility of basically Russian satellite or aerial photography capturing the Turks red-handed, handing supplies to al-Qaeda, and this getting out?
I don't know that that hasn't already happened. I think that...
Yeah, I don't even think that's controversial. The mainstream press already openly acknowledges that Turkey is supplying the rebels, and then they refer to the rebels as including al-Nusra. That's already openly admitted to. No one cares.
Yeah.
Now, if I could, I just want to make two other points. I want to go back to something Mark said, because I think it was really, really important. It was in his opening comments, and I kind of forgot to mention it when I responded. And that is the moves by Turkey, and especially this ridiculous but yet seemingly real threat from Saudi Arabia that they're going to lead, or at least in some token fashion, lead an invasion of Syria, allegedly to fight the Islamic State. I think that this is really important. I don't think it's a laughing matter at all, and not because I have any faith whatsoever in Saudi Arabia's military. I mean, they can't even do anything in Yemen. So, I mean, what are they going to be able to do in Syria, for God's sake? But what I do think is important is that this actually dovetails with something that we've been talking about here for weeks on end, that I've been harping on, Mark's been harping on all over the place, and that is the deconstruction of Syria. This deconstruction roadmap that the Brookings Institution and the Rand Corporation and the neocons writing in the New York Times and all of the rest of them, they've been talking about this for a long time. And
this is their plan B. They couldn't affect regime change, this is their plan B.
Right. And the question is, in what way do they achieve the deconstruction of Syria? Because there's actually a number of routes that they can go to get to that end goal. One of them that we have seen in recent weeks has been this the United States control over the Ramil Air Base, and essentially the United States hoping to be able to carve out what, in my opinion, I would describe as a terrorist enclave inside of territory that is increasingly being retaken by the Syrian Arab Army. So that's one element of
this.
But
let me on that. Could one mode of their doing that be essentially that Saudi Arabia announces it's sending troops in to fight Daesh? Then the Daesh people on the ground, like Scooby-Doo style, pull off their mask, and now they're Saudis.
Yeah.
Well, essentially, yes. I mean, that is ultimate. Look, as Mark was saying, he's absolutely right. Nobody serious, at least in the West, believes that there is that the Saudis are going to fight against ISIS. It's rather that the Saudis are ISIS, and the Saudis will fight against the Syrian Arab Army. I mean, that is what this is. So I think that we understand that, but My issue is what Mark was saying, and he's right, this Salafistan question or Sunnistan or a quote-unquote legitimate Islamic State. John Bolton wrote about it in the New York Times a few months back. I think it was in November, carving this out and creating a Sunni state out of a chunk of Syria and a chunk of Iraq.
Of Iraq as well.
Exactly, right. So that is ultimately where this seems to be heading. And it seems to me, just reading these reports, when they talk about Bahrain, I mean, come on, this is a joke. Saudi Arabia, all of these countries, that they're going to go in there and they're going to change what's happening on the battlefield against the Syrian Arab Army or against the Islamic State. Or nonsense. What they want to do is they want to force a carving up of Syria that they can then finally come back to the negotiating table with some level of strength. See, the problem with Geneva III is not, you know, what the Syrian government or even the Salafi terrorist groups or whatever. It has to do with who's coming from strength and who's coming from weakness. And when you have two parties that are coming to the table from totally different situations with totally different balance of power, there's not going to be a negotiation. It doesn't work that way. And so that, I think, is what they would like to do. The Russians, for their part, I think everybody understands that Russia has a long historical memory, and they understand very clearly the danger of an endless war in perpetuity that they don't make any progress in. So Russia does want negotiations, and Russia does want some kind of a settlement, but it has to be on terms that are favorable to their geopolitical and strategic alignment and vision, and that is not going to happen until they can have what I would call a modicum of concessions from the other side. And the other side isn't making any concessions, and that's part of the problem. They're, in fact, demanding that Russia and Syria make the concessions by stopping their military campaign. This is part of the problem here, is that this sort of lack of equilibrium is unfortunately a product of the war that the West has been waging and is now losing. Watch for them trying to carve up the country. Watch for the Syrian Arab Army trying to regain as much territory as they can before all of these developments happen.
Eric lays it out where, and maybe it was just the you know way you phrased it at the moment. It seems like though that Russia is looking for an affirmative gain or in any event an affirmative in its outcome, and really just a neutral outcome would suit their geopolitical purposes when you weigh it against the Daesh or you know the loss of Syrian state or whatever.
Yeah, that's a real question because at times there's a tendency to believe that Russia would accept geopolitical compromises on a very realist basis, but at other times Russia has really stuck by the Assad government, that this is the choice of the Syrian people, and certainly, their pursuit militarily completely flies in the face of what the West would consider acceptable political compromises. So I think Putin is really pissed, and I think he may be willing to go a little bit further than people think that Russia would be willing to go. I mean, remember, we've been reading for the last 5 years how Russia is about to throw Assad under the bus.
Mm-hmm, right.
And, you know, there should be a lot of crow served all the way around, and there's a lot of people who would still like to believe that.
Right.
I don't see it at this point. If he was going to, that would have already happened.
Yeah, it seems to me that Russia's interest, looking at their objective, at the country's objective interest, status quo ante 2011 isn't a bad situation for them.
I disagree. I disagree with that. The Russians are realists. Putin's a realist. Putin would not engage in this war solely for the sake of defending an ally, no matter how loyal or whatever. They want, in my opinion, a public relations advantage and a geopolitical and strategic advantage. On the public relations side, to some degree, they already have that. Look at how they've turned the Kurds. Look at how everybody in the region is now looking at Russia as a viable player and a viable partner. Where even a couple of years ago, that was not the case, and people in the region didn't see it that way. So from a public relations standpoint, Russia has, in some sense, already achieved a victory on that front. Not only that, but demonstrating to the world what Russian military capacity is, I think that was a significant box on their agenda that they've now checked off. I think furthermore, Russia wants to reestablish a military advantage in the region. And what that will mean, in my opinion, is that whenever a negotiated solution, whatever that looks like, comes about, it's going to come about with the legitimate and legal government of Syria in power that now allows Russia basing rights. Yeah. I think that Russia will have bases inside of Syria, and that will be one of the major strategic prizes that they take from all of this. And that, I think, changes significantly the complexion of the whole region.
Even if that's true, when I say status quo ante 2011, I'm talking about essentially there are no terrorist groups operating in Syria. The government in Damascus has full sovereignty. That being status quo ante.
Well, but that's victory. Victory.
Right. Because
that is complete victory. And that's already indicating that there's no compromise.
Right.
Because one of the insistence, Russia has been very firm on insisting both the secular nature of any political transition, that we maintain a secular state, and that Syria is undivided, that there is a unitary, non-federalist structure, no division of the country into different pieces, because simply from a national security perspective, which is one of the primary motivations, it's not just geopolitics for Russia. They have a very real national security set. Whether it's in a federated region or a carved out region, Russia cannot accept a Salafist Saudi puppet state in North eastern Syria. That's far too close to Russia's borders. We have a porous Caucasus, especially through Georgia with the Pankisi Gorge. Russia is still dealing with a smoldering Caucasus Emirates group, which has aligned itself with ISIS and before that with Al-Qaeda. We know that there's several thousand, at least 2,000 of these Caucasus Emiratis, and this is a mix of Chechens, Ingush, Dagestani, and a few other ethnic nationalities, all who have adopted a very Saudi Salafist Wahhabi ideological religious perspective. And Russia views these very seriously. It's a national security threat to Russia. And, you know, this is where I think Russia's willingness to compromise runs right up against even the plan B of, shall we say, the Washington neocons, at least, and in particular Saudi Arabia, and so on. I want to talk a little bit about, if Turkey and Saudi go in to Syria, invade Syria, what this will look like, so you know that we can identify it. One, of course, one of the rubrics will be for fighting Daesh. And I think it's very much, as you and Eric mentioned, that we will see that suddenly a lot of, you know, there will be announcements, oh, that we've driven off Daesh, and suddenly a lot of people that were previously fighting for Daesh suddenly become, you know, at the very least militias serving the Saudis in eastern Syria. Turkey will be talking about safe havens, all right? They will be using the call for refugees. We've seen similar things in the U.S. Senate hearings where they call about creating safe havens for our rebels that we're backing. And then they say, oh, and we can put refugees in there as well to make sure that the Russians can't hit them. It's that cynical, right? Yep. Using them as human shields. Now, there are already thousands of people fleeing Aleppo, the northern section of Aleppo, which has been Al-Qaeda, you know, and other jihadi controlled for several years now. And most of the people probably left in those areas are their families and people who, you know, basically agree with them. We've already seen thousands
or people who couldn't flee before. I think we should be, at least to some degree, objective about that. There's going to be tens of thousands of people who are caught in the middle of this, who, in one way or another, are victims of circumstances. Of
course. Yes, and that it's war, and it's a civil war. Right.
I just think that sometimes there's a tendency to oversimplify this matter, particularly by people who are, you know, pro-Syrian, pro, you know, government leanings, to say, well, all the people left there are terrorists and whatever. That's not true. There's a lot of people who are left there who are caught in the middle, and it's pretty tragic for them.
Syria, the Syrian government has been leafleting the area for weeks, saying get out of there, providing actually passes for them to take their families into Syrian government-controlled territory.
Right, but if you're the family of somebody who fought against the government, you're not taking that route.
No, of course not.
That's the problem. Yeah.
Here's the thing. Turkey has stopped them at the border. They are not letting them through. Which they have done previously, and certainly they've allowed enough jihadis to go back the other way. They are going to create a public display of a refugee crisis. And of course, this will play on European heartstrings and fears that these refugees could then end up in Europe as well, you know, hundreds of thousands more.
They're going to write to Greece. Turkey will give them a ride to Greece.
Yeah. They will cry for the establishment of safe havens. They will be talking about a humanitarian catastrophe. The Western press is already full of stories about Assad's starvation sieges and Russian carpet bombing of civilians. And they will be talking about the ethnic cleansing of the population of northern Syria. It has nothing to do with ethnic cleansing, of course. It's simply the cleansing of people who have a Salafist mentality that are willing to live under, or fight for an al-Qaeda style rule. This will be used to justify it. And certainly, the Syrian Arab Army is putting up sieges around towns. We've seen it in Madaya, and they're not letting supplies in, of course, to fuel them. Is this a deliberate policy of trying to starve the civilians? No, of course not. But these cities are being held hostage by rebels, and you don't see any of them starving, right?
Yeah, right.
They've got plenty of food, right?
They steal it. When the food aid goes in, they steal it, and then they sell it at exorbitant prices to raise funds.
I just had a online exchange last night with Miriam Elder, who is a senior editor for BuzzFeed, she has ethnic Russian descent. She's very anti-Russian. She was crying about the poor fate of people that could starve to death under Assad's brutal tactics. And I had to point out to her, there were just two towns north of Aleppo that were just freed in the past 2 days by the Syrian Arab Army that have been under West-backed rebel jihadist starvation siege for the last 3 years that were kept alive only by airdrops this entire time. Mm-hmm. Where were you crying about the people starving then?
Right.
Or if we take a look just down the Middle East just a little bit right now, the US and the UK are openly militarily helping the Saudi Axis military conquest of Yemen, which the UN has reported in the past 2 weeks, there are 14 million people literally starving to death because of the Saudi blockade of Yemen. No one is crying for the Shia there either.
No water for most of the millions of Yemenis either across the country. The water infrastructure has been blown up by the Saudis with the US AWACS helping.
Yeah. So whenever the West cries human rights or humanitarian catastrophe, it is always so facetious and so selective and so obviously a propaganda weapon I seriously hope no one takes it seriously. Wars are terrible things and terrible things happen and lots of innocent people die, but do not allow the West and God forsakes, don't allow Saudi Arabia or Turkey to use the humanitarian rhetoric to justify their military actions. They have been supporting a Islamist insurgency in this country, in Syria, and fueling it for the last 5 years. And I want to raise the question at the Syrian Donors Conference, what is the fraction? How much of a fraction is it, the money that they're spending on aid and refugees that are the backlash of their own operations compared on what they've spent on arms, training, and paying the salaries of the people who have been fighting in that country, fueling the conflict for the last 5 years?
Hey, Eric, I think we should jump into we had a report we wanted to do also. Well, first, you guys want to do a very quick kick about the and I'll take the heat for this, about the debate between Bernie and Hillary the other night.
I don't really, but I mean, I'm not really buying into any of this. I don't believe it. I think that Bernie has every opportunity to totally devastate Hillary Clinton publicly, and he chooses not to every single time. Why he's doing that? Is it because he's cowardly and a bad debater? Maybe. Is it because Bernie understands the sort of manufactured character of all of this? Possibly. ultimately, I've been saying the same thing for a long, long time. I continue to say it. This is Hillary Clinton's show. Hillary is destined, if she's assuming that, you know, barring some kind of bizarre, you know, twist in the Justice Department going rogue against the establishment and indicting her, which I'm not believing that's going to happen either. But assuming none of that happens, Hillary Clinton's path to the White House, I think, is pretty clear. I think that the questions on the Republican side, pretty interesting, because the Republicans have a very serious problem on their hands, because obviously anybody who watches Fox News, for example, well, woe unto you. But regardless of that, Fox News has made a major push since Iowa for Marco Rubio. This is clear where the establishment is shifting within the Republican Party for Marco Rubio. You hear what Trump is saying, that he might sue Ted Cruz, that, you know, all of these things are being stolen from him. Well, of course they are. Trump is being torpedoed by the Republican establishment. This is obvious. The question now becomes how the Republicans are going to constitute their side of this election. Now, I want to just give credit where credit is due. My friend Pascal Robert is the one who presented this scenario to me. I think it's pretty interesting. Don't know whether this will happen or not, but I want to make sure he gets credit for this. It's not my own original thought. He believes, and I think he has a great point here, the Republicans consolidate their position on a ticket of Marco Rubio and John Kasich as his running mate. Ultimately, John Kasich carries Ohio, a major swing state that Obama was able to seal his victories with. Rubio carries Florida for the Republicans as well. Republicans know without carrying Florida, North Carolina, Virginia, and Ohio, and possibly Colorado, they are doomed. It's the only way that they can win against the Democratic Party. I could see a Rubio Kasich ticket. I could see them moving to the center and trying to sideline Ted Cruz and Donald Trump and the rest of them. The danger for the Republicans is this. If they really do Trump as dirty as I think they will, Trump turns around and says, you wanna F with me, I'll F with you. And then he runs as a third party, takes 15% away from the Republicans, and the Republicans go down in flames to Hillary Clinton. I see that scenario playing out.
Which was just all along.
Yeah, exactly. That's what a lot of people
thought.
Let's go for a minute, though, back to the so-called debate. Because to me, And you touched on it, because Bernie Sanders doesn't go after Hillary Clinton, and whatever the motivation behind that. One thing, the context is that Sanders also has an imperial foreign policy. He's very clear about it, and that has to do with everything that's going on that we've been talking about in Syria and every place else. And of course, politically, if he wanted to go after Clinton, she's extremely vulnerable there, and a majority of public opinion, in Republicans and Democrats, would side with him, but he's not doing it. And to me, what I see happening is there's a consensus among all of the candidates, with the possible exception of Trump, that imperialism should be fostered and be our foreign policy. And all they're doing instead is fighting over the spoils. Sanders would like to distribute the spoils more equitably. And, yes, you know, the Republicans, of course, would like it to go, you know, more concentrated.
Sure.
But that's it.
Typical neocolonial mentality, figure out a better way to divide up the spoils of our domination of the rest of the world. I believe that. And I wouldn't exclude Trump from that. Trump is very much in that camp as well.
For sure. I'm just talking about in terms of tactics, at least. He was right. Like, well, maybe we could be friends with Russia.
Now,
I would,
I know Mark is a lot more hesitant than I am to go down what could be called the conspiracy road. But I also believe that Bernie Sanders is not attacking Hillary Clinton, because Bernie Sanders believes that it's quite likely that he could get a vice presidential nod and that Hillary Clinton doesn't really care so much about that, because Hillary Clinton is only interested in foreign policy. She's interested in war. She's interested in prosecuting war in the empire. She could give Bernie Sanders the vice presidential nod, knowing that Bernie Sanders carries the left for her. The left will not vote for Hillary Clinton, but they sure as hell will vote for Sanders, and that's how they'll justify voting for Clinton. Whoa, 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 whoa. We're not voting for Hillary. We're voting for Bernie.
Right. Mark?
Okay, well, I want to go on the record here that while I do not believe at all that Trump is, or at least in the beginning was, a serious candidate, I do believe that Bernie Sanders is a serious candidate. He probably started out like most left candidates do, simply as an issues to try to force issues on the primary race and force the addressing of some issues, maybe push the candidate a little bit further to the left and not expecting anything more. But he's had a lot more success than people give him credit for, which shows at least particularly among the Democratic Party how weak of a candidate Clinton really is.
Right.
Because of
the second time in a row,
liberal ties with Wall Street and everything. And I think that first of all, I think you know that we have to start taking Bernie Sanders' candidacy a little bit more seriously. First of all, because at least the Republican leadership has made it very clear that they actually believe we'll give them, you know, at least the benefit of the doubt here, that the FBI is about to drop an indictment on Clinton. And if that is true, that will certainly really change the shape of this game. Even if it's not, Bernie is showing a lot more strength. He's going to clean up New Hampshire, no doubt. And now he's polling within, you know, basically dead even within 2% nationally. That's a very interesting phenomenon. And it shows that, like Trumpism on the right, that the American people, or at least a significant portion of them, are really trying to look, you know, in the absence of any real third-party politics in the United States, which doesn't exist and isn't allowed to exist, looking for something outside that box, which is what Trump and Sanders both provide, or at least provide the illusion of.
I agree with that. Where I disagree is that the American people's opinion matters in the selection of a
president.
I don't think it does.
And we can stop there. That's a good point to stop at.
They have to at least sanctify it.
Yeah. we got a couple of things we got to touch on next week.
Absolutely. Yes. All right, we'll do that. And guys, thanks a lot. A pleasure as always.
Thanks, Don. Thanks, Mark. Love you guys.
Take care. Bye.
Next week.
You've been listening to CPR Sundays with Eric Dreitzer and Mark Sloboda. I'm Don DeBar, your host. Look forward to seeing you drop in again next week. Thanks for listening.